jump points forming right on top of us.
How many?
Four.
This is Ambassador Delenn of the Minbari. Babylon 5 is under our protection. Withdraw. Be destroyed.
Negative. We have authority here. Do not force us to engage your ship.
Why not? Only one human captain has ever survived battle with the Minbari fleet. He is behind me. You are in front of me. If you value your lives, be somewhere else.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard.
Welcome to the show, Lisa. Can you tell us a little about yourself?
Yes, first of all, thanks so much for having me on the show today, Andrea. I'm really excited to talk with you about my work. So I'm Professor Lisa Yezik, and I'm actually a Regents Professor of Science Fiction Studies in the School of Literature, Media, and Communication at Georgia Tech, and that's in Atlanta, Georgia, like below the Mason-Dixon line, for those of you who live up north and have never visited down here. So I'm really interested, as you might guess, in science fiction, and I'm particularly interested in science fiction as a global language. I think that in a world where we often feel like we are increasingly fragmented tribes that don't have much to say to each other, we actually do have quite a few things that hold us together. And science fiction is one of those. You can go almost anywhere in the world and talk to anyone about it. And even if they've never, ever experienced science fiction firsthand, somehow they'll still have an opinion about it and get you talking about it for at least half an hour, right? So I think that's really exciting, right? This is how we talk to each other about our hopes and our fears about science and technology and the future to each other across centuries, continents, and cultures. So I'm probably best known for my work in the recovery of women's science fiction and the discovery of new voices in science fiction as well. But really mostly, like I said, within women's science fiction, but I also do a lot of work in the recovery and discovery of Black science fiction voices as well, and scientists in science fiction, which, as you can imagine, is something people at Georgia Tech like to talk about quite a bit. So that's pretty much what I've been doing so far.
I love that you opened that with how science fiction can bring us together. There's so much. It kills me that everyone is often trying to find things that to argue about,
right?
Where talking about storytelling and talking about the future and talking about what if, that can bring us together right away.
Right. And it's not that we're not going to still have arguments, right? Because I think that what we can all agree on is that we want a better future for ourselves and the people who come after us. It's how we're going to get there, right? That's the trick. But if we can remember, right, that we all do have that sort of long-term goal together, it seems like it provides us with an opening. And like I said, science fiction, it acts like it's like a virtual laboratory. It's a place where we can test out a lot of these different futures and say, well, what if we did try going down this particular scientific or social road, or rather than this one?
That is exactly how I got into science fiction as a child. All of those what if questions. What if this happened? What if that happened? And every time I asked a question, somebody, you know, put a paperback in my hand and said, hey, read this. I first learned about you a few years ago from your anthology, The Future is Female. What inspired you to put that book together, and what was the creation process like?
So this was actually one of the times that I didn't come up with the idea. Actually, the Library of America came to me and asked me, well, they asked me for ideas. But what had happened was the Library of America is a huge nonprofit organization that's dedicated to the preservation and dissemination of American literature, broadly defined. And I just want to back up and explain this for a moment so you can understand how the project came to be. So earlier in the 2010s, when a lot of publishing companies were scaling back due to a variety of, you know, economic issues, the Library of America decided to go in the opposite direction and to expand their catalog. And while they had historically done traditional mainstream canonical American literature, they decided that genre fiction, right, is also so incredibly important to the American imagination and has been for a very, very long time. So they decided to start doing a different series of genre fictions books. So they've now got books on women's detective fiction, on classic detective fiction, on hard-boiled detective fiction. There are books on the Gothic, there are books on horror, and of course, books on science fiction. And I was really lucky that I was the first person that brought on to work on women's science fiction in particular. So they reached out to me because I already was establishing and had established really a reputation for the recovery of women's science fiction. And so they talked to me. They said, hey, we want to do this book. We don't necessarily know a lot. We know that Mary Shelley began the genre. We know that ever since the 1970s and the explosion of feminist science fiction, we've enjoyed like really amazing people like Ursula Le Guin and Joanna Russ and Martha Wells and N.K. Jemisin. And they're like, but surely there had to be something in there between 1818 and 1970. And I said, well, yes, there is indeed. And so we got to talking about that. And they were like, great, let's put together a book of these women and recover them, especially because one of the things that's so interesting to me that I find in my own research is that, again, we all tend to think there's no one between Mary Shelley and Ursula Le Guin, but the reality is women have always been a small but quite significant part of the science fiction community. And if you count all women science fiction creators in the professional industry, so writers, obviously, but also editors and poets and science journalists and illustrators, really, since the very beginning of commercial genre fiction in the 19-teens and 20s, there's been about, from then to the 70s, there were about 15% of the community was women. And that's pretty significant, right? And for some reason, we keep forgetting that. And a lot of my research has been driven by that. So it was really exciting to partner with the Library of America, who also very much want to reclaim these histories that have been lost, but that were very vibrant and real and obviously, you know, central to many people's lives. So that was really exciting. And it was wonderful. The Library of America was very supportive. They really gave me a free hand with choosing stories. And then they also really, we wanted to make sure that these books would appeal to a wide variety of people. And we knew we could handle the like maybe 40-year-old up group, but we wanted to make sure we had young people involved. And so one of the things we've been doing that's been very exciting on the Future is Female books is that we bring student researchers on to work with us. So they get an opportunity to see a little bit what like professional publishing is like. And we get some very smart, very energetic young people who can build all kinds of marvelous little programs to crawl the web and help us find stories and details about authors. And it's really been an exciting opportunity for all of us. So it's cool to be not only recovering futures written by women and where we imagine women building the future, but to actually have students who are often women or certainly feminist friendly working on this as well.
What a great look into the background of how these kinds of books come together. Oftentimes when I ask people, oh, how did this anthology come together? The answer is I grabbed a bunch of stories and got the rights and I had an anthology. So I'm,
oh, that's pretty cool too, though.
but getting researchers involved and having such a free hand, that's...
Yeah, I was going to say, there was one challenge at working with Library of America. And it's not a bad challenge, but it was surprising at first. And now we're all very used to it. But that... their standards for what counted as good science fiction weren't necessarily always in line with those of the community, especially early science fiction, which science fiction before the 1940s looks very different than what we're really used to with more modern science fiction. And as my point editor there diplomatically put it, these stories are chock full of ideas, but not so much full of great literary grace. So
that's
we
so
had
true.
To, it is true. It is true. But I'm like, but the energy and the heart, and that was important too at the time. Like you had to do that before you could build the literary aspects of it. So we had to do some negotiation. And I have to admit some stories I adore did not make it, but that's also the process of anthologizing. And the beauty is you're like, fine, then I'll do another anthology with those stories.
And that leads me into another question. I know you must have identified probably 100 stories that you wanted to include. How did you narrow it down? What did you do with the stories that didn't make the cut? Right. And I'm very, very fascinated to hear you knew what you were looking for. Mm-hmm. Other editors knew what they were looking for. How did that dichotomy work?
It actually worked out really well. I mean, like I said, there were definitely some moments where we had to make some compromises and I lost some things, but they lost some things they really liked too, that I was just like, these were in no way central to science fiction. And it would be weird to put them in here and they're not that great from my perspective. But what we did find is we had lots of overlap. So that was really good. And what was really cool about the first book was how hands-on everyone at Library of America was. Like, it was, everyone read the stories along with me. So I would, they did a first run of stories that they pulled and gave to me. And I said, okay, I think some of these are really cool. Some of these maybe not so much. And then I went through and using my, you know, my research, pulled together a more comprehensive list. And then we read and we ranked stories. We put up a spreadsheet and people would put in their notes about it. And it was great, especially because a lot of people at Library of America turn out they're very into science fiction, including the owner publisher. And so that was super fun. But also sometimes you get people who were super into reading the stories because they're like, oh, I want to read about feminism or I want to do this pop culture work, but I don't know that much. And so their comments would be hilarious. And they'd be like, the worm baby story. We have to put in the worm baby story, which is Judith Merrill's That Only a Mother. But just like, they'd get so enthusiastic and the descriptions were really fun and surprising. So
that had to be very, very surprising. Working with folks that maybe this was their first exposure to science fiction written by women that was written then.
Yes.
You know, if you're used to reading N.K. Jemisin.
It looks very different than like the housewife heroine fiction of the 1950s, which in its own way had the same kind of political edge at that moment. But right now to us looks often much more trivial than I think it was at the time. We forget how much progress has been made sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that Judith Merrill story, like that story is still just like cemented on the back of my eyeballs. I will never escape that story.
No one ever does. I teach a history of science fiction class every year and I change the stories all the time because there's so much great stuff, but there are maybe two stories I never change, and the Merrill story is one of them because the students absolutely love that story. They're just shook by it.
Yeah,
especially because right at the beginning, you're like, oh, Margaret's crazy. And then I'm like, is she now? Let's go back and look at that. And they're like, oh, no, she's not crazy. He's crazy. Oh, they're both crazy. Oh, this whole situation's crazy. It's great.
That was my experience. I, you know, I'm reading that story in the first couple of pages. I'm thinking, okay, where is this going? Something's really off here and I can't quite figure out what. I'm not going to start gaslighting this lady, but something's really weird.
Yeah.
And yes, I was absolutely, absolutely shook by it.
Yeah. And that is a story that has great literary technique as well as a really gut-wrenching political message, right? And it's entertaining as well as my kids sometimes like to say, edutainment, right? It's sort of, you've got both of those things at once, which I think science fiction often wants to do, right? It wants to be both didactic and entertaining. But my students this summer, we read that story and they just refused. They were just like, no, we're not doing this ending. And so they came back in the next class and we were reading Robert Heinlein's All You Zombies, which is a time travel story. And they're like, we've solved the problem. We're going to just mash those up and we're going to send Heinlein's time traveler over to save the baby. And then the baby will be raised with Jane in the orphanage and then they'll never be alone. And like, they just solved all the problems. And then I was like, so where is the mom going to go? And they're like, oh, we're going to recruit her into the time agency. and then like, what about the dad? And they're like, let him die. We hate him. So I was like, oh my goodness, harsh justice here. And they would do this every new unit. They would like, they'd say, okay, we have a new way to save Henrietta. Now we're going to save the baby using these characters doing this. So it was really, they were very committed to saving that little baby. It was really touching.
Are you going to rename that course, Save the Baby?
Save the Baby. We should save the mutant baby and other fine stories from the science fiction community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's true. Befriend the alien, save the mutant baby. That's pretty much the lessons they learned, I think.
Yeah, it's okay. Now I am now you've got me committed to I've got to save the baby.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, sometimes science fiction stories do not have a happy ending.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah.
Well, and Merrill Plant wrote plenty of those. And a lot of the housewife heroine stories have, I mean, that story has a terrible ending, right? I mean, everyone's always like, he's just hugging the baby. And you're like, with his hands or fingers on her throat? Yeah, maybe. So,
yeah,
it's a tough one. But what can you say? We're both stunned even thinking about
it. Yes, just very, very stunned, very shook.
Yeah.
And the good news for everybody is there is another volume of The Future is Female coming out. What can you share with us about the next volume?
Yeah, so the next volume is the 1970s, right? So the first volume went through the 1920s up through the 1960s until the advent of feminist science fiction. And so this volume is just 100% the 1970s and the rise of feminist science fiction. And obviously women were writing lots of different kinds of science fiction in the 1970s. It's a really important moment, right? So this is the moment where we see the revival of feminism and the rise of women's studies and gender studies programs in universities. And those two things together are going to be really transformative within science fiction for at least a certain segment of women and feminist-friendly men. And, right, so all of a sudden you have people sort of questioning like the way that we've written science fiction and the gendered assumptions we make. We have people experimenting with female futures, right? And we have, like I said, men and women alike sort of exploring gender and trying to think past the gender binary. It's a really exciting moment. And while people were doing this earlier in science fiction, right, the big difference now is that earlier, those people were very rarely connected to each other. There could be dozens of women writing, but they didn't talk that often, and they certainly didn't see themselves as a group. And they were only inconsistently presented as a group, usually by critics who just liked housewife heroine fiction or other kinds of women written science fiction. But by the 1970s, you have a whole new group of women who are coming in, plus the veterans from two or three other generations, you know, including, I just forgot her name. One of the authors we've included is Miriam Allen DeForge. She was 83 when she wrote the story that we included. And she had been writing science fiction since the 1930s. So that was very exciting, or 1940s. So what's really exciting, right? The 70s, you have the revival of feminism. You have this whole new group of women, plus all the women who had been in science fiction together. And the numbers begin to go up. And by the end of the 70s and into the 80s, we get the number of women in science fiction double, and it gets up to about 30%. And we're not that much higher today. We're still at 30 to 40%, depending on what you count as a science fiction or fantasy magazine. But it was a really powerful moment where it really looked like, just like it looked like America was changing with Title IX, with Roe versus Wade, with women going into the workforce and into the military, right? That women were also transforming science fiction, and men too. But people were really trying to think of new ways to do it. And that was super exciting. And we really wanted to capture that in this volume. So that was, I think, one of the most exciting things. And the other exciting thing was this time around, we brought the students in to do readings from the very beginning. So rather than having Library of America and me do all the reading, we still did it. But the students, we had a group of four women, actually, who went through and did all the, and then a fifth one joined later, did all the reading and ranking on the stories initially. And it was so cool to get like the impression of very young women reading very old feminist science fiction.
Because you say you're mentioning students. So I'm assuming, you know, 19 years old, 21, 22 years old.
Yeah. 19 to 24, I think was the age range in my group.
Yeah. And, you know, they're reading fiction that was written in the 70s, written likely by women who were born in the 40s.
Yeah.
And so there's that generational shift.
Yeah. It's the literature of their grandparents.
Yes.
That's what they were talking about. They presented with me at a number of conferences, and this is something that they really talk about, is how much this literature celebrates the dreams and the gains of their own grandmothers and how it inspires them to continue that legacy, which is really, I think, so cool.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Our guest today is Lisa Yazyk. Did you know? We're on Twitter at Retro Rockets Pod. Show notes and more episode information can also be found at retrorocketspodcast.wordpress.com. As you were describing how things were changing in the 70s, all I could imagine was being a fly on the wall in some of those conversations between the newer writers and the previous generation who were bringing up their literary daughters, joyously seeing this next generation coming up.
Well, joyous for some, right? And profoundly alarming for others, right? This is the moment of, you know, feminist science fiction comes up at the moment of the new wave, which was an experimental, a very avant-garde moment in science fiction, right? And there's a lot of overlap between feminist and new wave science fiction. But you also had, of course, a contingent of older, more established writers, often men, but not exclusively by any stretch of the imagination, who hated this stuff. They were like, what are you people doing? Science fiction is about science and technology, not about people's feelings about these things and how it changes society. And so there was actually quite a bit of, you know, headbutting between different members of the community. And we do know that, you know, Joanna Russ, who was really the architect, I would say, of feminist science fiction, both in terms of criticism and in terms of writing fiction, she burned out, you know? I mean, she fought the good fight from the mid-60s till about the 80s. And then she did still write a little science fiction in the 80s and 90s, but mostly she turned her efforts into, I leaned into feminism at that point, because she's just like, we tried so hard, and you only get so far before everyone gets very mad at you for taking apart like their most dearly cherished like hopes and dreams and narrative forms. So it's an exciting moment, but I think it must have also, like you said, it would be great to be a fly on the wall, because it would be a very tense moment as well. And I would actually point out to you and to anyone else who's listening who wants to be a fly on the wall, there are ways you can do that. Obviously, you can buy the Futurist Female Anthology and see what women were writing about and what was getting some people so upset. But also, you can find so many resources online. And this is something that my students and I were really excited about, is it's not a perfect archive by any stretch of the imagination, but you can go online and find things like, there was a symposium held by a fanzine called Khatru, K-H-A-T-R-U, in the mid-1970s. And it was a symposium on women in science fiction. And the editor, he got all the big name feminists there. He had Joanna Russ, he had Ursula Le Guin, he had Raylan Moore, who was actually not a feminist writer, but a woman science fiction writer who was actually kind of skeptical of feminism, friendly to the cause, but also not doing it in a writing. So he wanted to get a range of voices. He had Louise White, who was a very young fan and one of the few African-Americans in the community at the time. That was exciting. Samuel Delaney was there as, you know, just the sort of token good guy on the side of feminism. And also James Tiptree, when everyone still thought Tiptree was a man. And actually, for those of you who don't know, Tiptree was actually a feminist science fiction author named Alice Sheldon. And the debates they have, you know, and it's amazing. You have all these people who are, in theory, all feminists and all science fiction authors, and they can't agree on a thing. The whole symposium starts from the first question. The authors are like, that's a terrible question. And then they just start arguing about everything. Fascinating.
This sounds like every science fiction convention and bar con I've ever been to. And I say that as a compliment.
Yes.
Where everyone is arguing, but they're also, they're all part of the same tribe. And they're arguing from a place of love.
Yes, this was largely from a place of love. There was also many places of irritation. And I think this is one thing that those of us who are younger don't remember, and who are the inheritors of that wave of feminism. It was a lot of work, right? Like, first wave feminism, like, sort of, it did its work. And then, you know, we went very anti-feminist in America for a long time, like almost 50 years. And by the time women got back to it and were kind of being allowed forcing spaces where they would be allowed to speak, like, people were angry, right? And this is something that really is characteristic of feminism, that moment. And you can see people losing their temper. Like, Samuel Delaney spends like 4 pages talking about what an awesome feminist he is, because he like very carefully watches his wife's struggles, and sometimes he babysits the kid. I know. And everyone's like, you know what? That's just not acceptable. You can just stop talking now. And it is very interesting. But then even the women start arguing over what is feminism going to be, and like, what is the end agenda of it? And it's interesting. There's definitely more love, I think, almost between the women sometimes than the men. Although I understand that Joanna Russ and James Tiptree were actually doing backdoor deals, because this whole thing was being carried out by writing over the course of a year. And meanwhile, they had a separate correspondence and telephone conversation going on that was sort of nudging the conversation in certain areas, which was cool. Actually, probably not telephone, since everyone still thought Tiptree was a man then. So probably just writing.
Just letters. Yeah, letters back and forth.
Or if you find old magazines, a lot of times now people are scanning the old magazines and putting them online. You can go read like the letters to the editors and things. If you want to see people arguing, it's amazing. Yeah, people argued the way they do like on the internet and Reddit now, but in science fiction, you know, a century before things like that existed, before we had bulletin boards.
I had found some old scans of like Galaxy Magazine and IF, and I started this search looking for very specific short stories that I knew had been published in particular volumes of particular magazines.
Yeah.
The best part was reading the letters to the editor.
Yes, they're really interesting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny that, you know, everything people are arguing about now, because that is the eternal argument of science fiction. Is science fiction about ideas, or is science fiction about what people are going to do with those ideas?
Right. Yes.
You know, we argue nonstop on Twitter. We argue nonstop on Reddit. That argument's been going on for 200 years, probably longer.
Yes, absolutely. And in a form that it changes, it doesn't change that much as we switch media. We keep sort of having that. But to me, that's one of the fun things about being a cultural historian, is we now, for the first time really ever, have a chance to really begin accessing historical archives in ways we just absolutely couldn't before digital technology. And we can share that information in ways we couldn't before. And what a wonderful moment to maybe actually break away or rethink science fiction's commitment to the future, but also think about its commitment to the past, right? This is something you see a lot in Afrofuturism and indigenous futurism, is not just thinking about the future, but the past in relation to the future. And I feel like, right, looking at these histories to me is so important, because we walk into situations like the pandemic or the revival of the civil rights movement, and we say we've never been in these spaces before, but we have historically a lot. And there are records of this, and there are people who for hundreds of years have documented this and told stories about it, and maybe given us some ways to help think about it, like some frameworks that might help us approach some of the problems we have today. Like, what stories have we already told, and what are the new ones we can tell?
I know this wasn't in the list of conversation questions that I sent you. Anything you want to talk about Afrofuturism, I am all ears.
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, sure. Let's talk about Afrofuturism for a little while, because I think that, you know, if we're all willing to acknowledge, I think increasingly, that women have been in science fiction as long as men. You know, the other thing that we want to think about is that white Eurocentric people, right, don't have a lock on science fiction storytelling. It's certainly true that in its modern form, it became popular in the West. And it makes sense, because it's been hooked to Western techno-scientific development, right, and to colonization efforts as well. Having said that, right, every culture in the world, every group of people has speculative stories. Really serious ones, right? Going all the way back to, like, as the minute people started putting together literature or you know, writing ideograms and cuneiform on walls, they're telling kinds of stories about, like, how do we make sense of space and time and the moon and the stars and things like that, and how our bodies work. And sometimes the stories feel pretty prescient. Like, there's a lot of time dilation stories in like the Ramayana and other Indian sacred texts. And you're like, wow, that is amazing that they were thinking about how time might run differently that early on, right? So this will get us now to Afrofuturism, right? So people have been doing this work for forever. And, you know, the thing is, though, Black people have been telling speculative stories too. And, right, we have Black people, a friend of mine right now and I are writing what we're calling a People's History of Science Fiction. And it's a lot like the Howard Zinn People's History of America. It's a bottom up rather than a top down history, and one that focuses on the diversity of people and diversity of speculative traditions that really now inform science fiction. And so one of the things that I've been looking at is that, so Afrofuturism, for those of you who don't know it, it's not just Black science fiction. It's a mode of speculative fiction that exists alongside science fiction and has forever, almost, I'd say, certainly since before the founding of the United States itself. Now, a lot of us tend to think about Afrofuturism. So this is a kind of fiction that uses the language of science fiction and fantasy and horror to help us rethink our ideas about science, technology, and race, and to imagine futures in full color, right? That it's not just all a white IKEA future populated by white people, but that instead, right, that we are going to have truly global futures. And honestly, science fiction's always kind of wanted to imagine those. It just hasn't always done a great job. We're getting better, I think, right?
And yeah, Afrofuturism, we're slowly getting better.
Slowly. But Afrofuturism is one of the ways we're doing this. And just think about Black Panther, all right? There you go. If you don't know Afrofuturism and you saw Black Panther, you do know Afrofuturism. But a lot of you will have read N.K. Jemisin, who's an amazing Afrofuturist and the first author of any race or gender to win 4 Hugos in a row, right? Pretty impressive work there. Right. So this is really cool stuff, but we tend to think about Afrofuturism as a very new phenomenon. And that's in part because it was only named by critics as such in the 1990s. And when those first critics were putting together these first histories, they sort of went back and they looked at Sam Delaney, who they were talking with, of course. So some early Black science fiction authors, and they spoke with the great jazz musician Sun Ra, of course, who has always presented himself as being from the planet Jupiter, right? And that he's come back to Earth to remind Black people that all Black people are actually from the stars, and that they came to Earth to help white people evolve, but then things went sort of tragically wrong, right? Stranded ancient astronauts, but things are getting back on track now, right? So great story, wonderful. But one of the things I've always been interested in is that, of course, Black people, like white people, have been telling speculative stories since before we had the names for these things. And as I look back at it, I think we can trace Afrofuturism all the way back to Phyllis Wheatley, the enslaved colonial poet of the 1700s. And Wheatley, if you go back and look at her poems, she's writing about getting on the mothership of imagination and sailing into the heavens. And then, like, when all the other white angels go split off to hang out with God, she and the other Black artists she's sailing around with measure. They take the measure of the universe and they write and create art about it. And I was just like, wow, that's so crazy, especially because much later on, when George Clinton and Parliament were doing Afrofuturism through their sort of funkadelic music and they built the mothership, they always said the mothership was supposed to be an expression of imagination. And it's cool that you can see that all the way back before the founding of the United States itself.
That is absolutely beautiful. Just absolutely beautiful.
Isn't that cool stuff? And
yes.
Of course, right, like Indigenous people have amazing kinds of stories about beings from other dimensions and multiple universes and things that really kind of predate string theory in some amazing ways as well. So America has such a rich tradition of speculative fiction, even before we're either America or we actually have those words in our mouths.
And it's, us, like white people love to say, look what I created. And everyone else is saying, dude, what took you so long? We've been there for hundreds of years.
It's true. Right. Exactly. But, at least now we're having these dialogues and we're able to explore these things, right? And so just as over the last 50 years, we've seen a lot of men in the science fiction community go from actively criticizing feminist science fiction to using a lot of those techniques within their own fiction just as it's evolved, I think we'll start to see that with race as well. We're already beginning to see like cool new character types that are coming in through other storytelling traditions. And even beginning to see, right, debates about whether or not white artists, how and when they can use these other kinds of Indigenous stories and techniques in their own fiction. And I think that that's a cool debate. I'm excited that we're having that.
I hope it doesn't take too long for those methods and those, for all of that to just become, well, of course that's in this book.
Right.
You know, of course that's in this story. I want it to be mainstream.
Right. Yeah, I do too. Right. It's like when at the end of Joanna Russ's The Female Man, which is this really biting critique of modern patriarchal society told from the perspective of four women in four different universes. Right. And at the end, the woman in the universe most like her own writes the book, The Female Man, and sends it out into the world. And she echoes Mary Shelley's dedication to Frankenstein, says, go, little book, you know, entertain the masses. But then she goes past Shelley and she imagines a far future where her book is languishing in the corners of the halls of Congress and gathering dust because no one even understands anymore what she's writing about. And right, that's the future we all, I think, want.
Yeah, it's where it's not needed anymore because
right.
We have finally grown past it.
I know, although then we'll just move on to new and other gnarly problems, right? That's what the post-humanist science fiction authors tell us.
Yes, all that, the gray goo that eats the solar system?
Yeah.
I want to make sure we touch on some of the other books that you've written. You wrote Galactic Suburbia. You wrote you did Sisters of Tomorrow. Let's take just a couple of minutes and talk about those.
Right. So Galactic Suburbia was actually that book that really launched my interest in the recovery of women's science fiction, and it grew out of a course I was teaching at Georgia Tech that I was hired in to do gender studies in science fiction. And I was teaching our history of science fiction class. I was getting ready to do that for the first time. And I thought, you know, I don't want to just do the greatest hits. Like, this is a good chance for me to learn some new stuff, too. And I knew that my predecessor at Tech, who had started our science fiction studies program, he had donated 8,000 volumes to the library. I'm like, well, surely some of the anthologies will give me some new stuff. And when I started looking at these anthologies from the 40s and 50s, I saw a world of women and names I hadn't heard. Like, I knew Meryl. My parents were good feminists and good science fiction fans. Like, I knew Meryl. I knew Carol M. Schwiller. But there were dozens and even scores of these women all of a sudden. And I didn't. I was like, who is this Alice Eleanor Jones who won these awards? And who is this woman who was an editor at Esquire magazine, right? And it was so exciting to find. And who is this woman who was an early suffragette? And it was just so bananas to find these women. And they were so clearly appreciated by other editors. And that was the rabbit hole I went down, and I had to know more. And that's when I really realized there was a lot of history out there that had been forgotten, and it seemed like a good time to bring it back.
Excellent. I want everybody who's listening to this to look up these books on Amazon and order them and look at them and enjoy them.
That's great.
Yeah. So, anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about?
So Galactic Suburbia is the scholarly book. So you're going to have to be prepared for that. I speak in clear, small sentences, so you're all cool. And I describe a lot of stories. And that's actually what got me to start doing anthologies, is that as we were recovering these stories, my editor is like, these are amazing, but no one can get access to them except you because you're at a university. And she's like, well, our press doesn't do this, but you need to start editing anthologies and bringing this work out. And that's what led to Sisters of Tomorrow. Was I started working with another press, Wesleyan, which was very interested in doing that kind of recovery. So, and then that led to the Future is Female series. And that's been really exciting. So it's been wonderful getting to visit with all these women in the past. And we're actually going to start a new project called Octavia's Ancestors, because we want to know where were all the Black women writing science fiction between Phyllis Wheatley and Octavia Butler. So that's a new project we're going to be starting. And I hope that maybe I can come back in some time and share with you some marvelous new voices we found from like African-American science fiction history.
I am absolutely looking forward to that. So much.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. I hope we find something.
Yes. Oh, I don't doubt it. I know you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone dreams, and like lots of people like to write about it. And newspapers used to publish this stuff. It was super exciting. I want to go back to the world where we run like science fiction stories right next to the major headlines of the day, right? So just as you're starting to see like all the really dystopian things in the news cycle, maybe you can have a little good news from the future as well.
That sounds so wonderful. Thank you so very much for your time, Lisa.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been so much fun.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.